person is, and come to love the person for him or herself, and not just for the feelings and experiences they give us. Only with time do we learn the particular needs of our spouse and how to meet them. Eventually, all this leads to wells of memory and depths of feeling and enjoyment of the other person that frames and enhances the still crucial episodes of romantic sexual passion in your married life. Emotion and action. How does this work itself out in day-to-day married life? Nearly everyone thinks that the Bible's directive to love your neighbor is wise, right, and good. But notice that it is a command, and emotions cannot be commanded. The Bible does not call us to like our neighbor, to have affection and warm feelings toward him or her. No, the call is to love your neighbor, and that must primarily mean displaying a set of behaviors. The feeling of affection, of course, is a natural part of love, and it can enable us to better perform the actions of love. We are never more satisfied and fulfilled than when affection and action are joined in us, when we are serving someone we delight in. Nevertheless, if we don't distinguish between feelings and action, it can put huge barriers in the way of loving people. One reason we need to make this distinction is because of the sheer inconsistency of our feelings. They are tied to complex physical, psychological, and social factors. They wax and then wane, often in infuriating ways. Our emotions are not under our control, but our actions are. Most of our likes and dislikes are neither sins nor virtues, no more than our tastes in food or music. What matters is what we do with them. If, as our culture encourages us, we go so far as to define love as liking, if we only feel that actions of love are authentic, if there are strong feelings of love present, we will inevitably be bad friends and even more terrible family members and spouses. It is a mistake to think that you must feel love to give it. If, for example, I have a child, and I give up my day off to take him to a ball game, to his great joy, at a time when I don't particularly like him, I am in some ways being more loving to him than if my heart were filled with affection. When you feel great delight in someone, meeting their needs and getting their gratitude and affection in return is extremely rewarding to your ego. At those times, you may be acting more out of the desire to get that love and satisfaction yourself, rather than out of a desire to seek the good of the other person. As Kierkegaard observed, you may not be loving that person so much as loving yourself. And when we only do the actions of love when we are having strong feelings of love, we often love unwisely. Parents out of love can spoil their children. Spouses out of love can enable destructive behavior in each other. The reason this happens is that we are, above all, afraid of the displeasure of the beloved. We are afraid that he or she will be angry and say harsh things, and we cannot bear that. This only affirms that we don't really love the person and his or her best interest. We love the affection and esteem we are getting from that person. All this means that you can indeed love, and love truly and wisely, when you lack the feelings of love. So if your definition of love stresses affectionate feelings more than unselfish actions, you will cripple your ability to maintain and grow strong love relationships. On the other hand, if you stress the action of love over the feeling, you enhance and establish the feeling. That is one of the secrets of living life, as well as of marriage. Actions of love lead to feelings of love. In one of his BBC radio talks during World War II, C.S. Lewis expounded on the basic Christian virtues, including those of forgiveness and charity, or love. For the British, the world was then unavoidably divided into allies and enemies. In that situation, Lewis said, many of his countrymen and women found the Christian doctrine of forgiving and loving all human beings to be not just impossible but repugnant. This sort of talk makes me sick, many said to him. But Lewis went on to argue that, despite feelings of indifference and even contempt, you can change your heart over the long haul through your actions. He said, "Though natural likings should normally be encouraged, it would be quite wrong to think that the way to become charitable is to sit trying to manufacture affectionate feelings. The rule for all of us is perfectly simple. Do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as we do this, we find one of the great secrets. When you are behaving as if you loved someone, you will presently come to love him. If you injure someone you dislike, you will find yourself disliking him more. If you do him a good turn, you will find yourself disliking him less. Whenever we do good to another self, just because it is a self made like us by God, and desiring its own happiness as we desire ours, we shall have learned to love it a little more, or at least to dislike it less. The worldly man treats certain people kindly because he likes them. The Christian, trying to treat everyone kindly, finds himself liking more and more people as he goes on, including people he could not even have imagined himself liking at the beginning." Lewis then used an illustration that had great potency, particularly at that time. He said, "This same spiritual law works terribly in the opposite direction. The Germans, perhaps, at first ill-treated the Jews because they hated them. Afterwards, they hated them much more because they had ill-treated them. The more cruel you are, the more you will hate. And the more you hate, the more cruel you will become. And so on, in a vicious circle, forever." Early in my ministry, I discovered this practical insight in an unexpected way. A pastor is required to befriend a lot of people that he would never otherwise choose as friends. Doctors and counselors talk sympathetically and personally with people, but that happens within the strict confines of the office and the work week. Pastors live with the people they shepherd. They visit with them and eat and play with them, in restaurants and parks and in their homes, all the while talking to them about their life issues and problems. As a young minister, I was immediately struck by how different a life this called me to live. Like everyone else, up till that time, I had let my likings and affections strictly determine who I spent time with. When I moved to Hopewell, Virginia, and took the church, however, I met plenty of people in the congregation that, if I had moved there with some other job, I would not have pursued as friends. It wasn't that I didn't like them. I just shared no affinities with them. There was no spark of the kind you feel when you want to spend more time with someone. Nevertheless, as their pastor, if anyone needed to talk to me at 3 a.m., I was there. If they went to the hospital, I was there. If a family son ran away from home, I got in my car and went to find him. I sat in their homes, went to their children's graduations, went to their family picnics. I shared my heart with them as they shared theirs with me. That's what it is to be a pastor, especially in a smaller church in a small town. I was called upon to do all the actions of love with a lot of people to whom I was not emotionally drawn. And it changed me. This came home to Kathy and me one day after we'd been at the church only a couple of years. We had a midweek day off and were deciding how to spend it. I thought of a particular couple in the church and proposed that we visit them or have them over. She looked at me astonished and said, "Why on earth?" This particular couple had few or no friends. They had many personal problems that made them unattractive to others and indeed to each other. Kathy certainly understood the need to see them and spend time with them, but this was our day off. And surely time with this couple was ministry work. For a moment I was surprised by her surprise, and then I laughed when I saw what had happened. For months I had been investing much time, thought, and emotion into helping this couple move forward in life. In short, I had been doing various actions of love: listening, serving, sympathizing, confronting, forgiving, affirming, sharing. And after all that, I realized I'd actually come to like them. Why did that happen? Was it because I was so holy and spiritual? No, not in the slightest. It was because I'd stumbled on to the practical principle that Lewis named. I had been loving them even when I didn't like them, and the result was that, slowly but surely, my emotions were catching up with my behavior. If you do not give up, but proceed to love the unlovely in a sustained way, they will eventually become lovely to you. Our culture says that feelings of love are the basis for actions of love, and of course that can be true. But it is truer to say that actions of love can lead consistently to feelings of love. Love between two people must not, in the end, be identified simply with emotion or merely with dutiful action. Married love is a symbiotic, complex mixture of both. Having said this, it is important to observe that of the two, emotion and action, it is the latter that we have the most control over. It is the action of love that we can promise to maintain every day. Deciding to love. How important is this principle to marriage itself? It is crucial. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 28, Paul says, "Husbands ought to love their wives." He had already urged them to love their wives in verse 25, but here, just to be clear, Paul uses a verb that stresses obligation. There is no doubt about what Paul is saying. He commands husbands. They ought to love their wives. Emotions can't be commanded, only actions. And so it is actions that Paul is demanding. He doesn't care how they feel on a given day or at a given moment. They must love their wives. Does that mean it doesn't matter who you marry? That you don't have to be in love with the person you wed, or that emotion is unimportant in marriage? No. I am not proposing that you deliberately marry a person you don't like. But I can guarantee that whoever you marry, you will fall out of like with them. Powerful feelings of affection and delight will not and cannot be sustained. It is quite typical to lose the head-over-heels feelings for your mate even before you get married, because our emotions are tied to so many things within our physiology, psychology, and environment. Your feelings will ebb and flow, and if you follow our culture's definition of love, you may conclude that this can't be a person you should marry. Our culture glorifies romantic passion, and so we say, if this was the person for me to marry, my feelings wouldn't be so up and down. In a chapter called Christian Marriage, in Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis writes, "People get from books the idea that if you have married the right person, you may expect to go on being in love forever. As a result, when they find they are not, they think this proves they have made a mistake and are entitled to a change, not realizing that, when they have changed, the glamour will presently go out of the new love just as it went out of the old one." In any relationship, there will be frightening spells in which your feelings of love seem to dry up. And when that happens, you must remember that the essence of a marriage is that it is a covenant, a commitment, a promise of future love. So what do? You do the acts of love, despite your lack of feeling. You may not feel tender, sympathetic, or eager to please, but in your actions, you must be tender, understanding, forgiving, and helpful. And if you do that, as time goes on, you will not only get through the dry spells, but they will become less frequent and deep. And you will become more constant in your feelings. This is what can happen if you decide to love. C.S. Lewis writes, "This is, I think, one little part of what Christ meant by saying that a thing will not really live unless it first dies. It is simply no good trying to keep any thrill. That is the very worst thing you can do. Let the thrill go. Let it die away. Go on through that period of death into the quieter interest and happiness that follow, and you will find you are living in a world of new thrills all the time." How is this transformation possible? I think it may happen something like this. When we first are attracted to someone, we think, "I want it to stay like this. I don't want to lose this passion." But as we have said, that ego rush cannot be sustained. and cannot take you very far down the road of learning to love the person you really married. To use Lewis's metaphor, you must let this more immature incarnation of your love die if it is to rise again and live. You must stick to your commitment to act and serve in love even when, no, especially when, you don't feel much delight and attraction to your spouse. And the more you do that, slowly but surely, you will find your more ego-heavy attraction being transformed into a love that is more characterized by a humble, amazed reception and appreciation of the other person. The love you will grow into will be wiser, richer, deeper, less variable. Sadly, many people never let this happen because they have accepted the culture's definition of marriage, and when the thrill wears off, they feel it is time for a change. This view of things leaves married people very vulnerable to affairs, since it is quite natural that you will meet others who are attractive and who will hold out the promise of getting the thrill back that was there in the beginning of your relationship with your spouse. Again, here's a passage from C.S. Lewis. Another notion we get from novels and plays is that falling in love is something quite irresistible, something that just happens to one, like measles. And because they believe this, some married people throw up the sponge and give in when they find themselves attracted by a new acquaintance. But is it not very largely in our own choice whether this love shall or shall not turn into what we call being in love? No doubt if our minds are full of novels and plays and sentimental songs and our bodies full of alcohol, we shall turn any love we feel into that kind of love. Just as if you have a rut in your path, all the rainwater will run into that rut, and if you wear blue spectacles, everything you see will turn blue. But that will be our own fault. So when someone says, "I don't need a piece of paper to show love," you might say, "Yes, you do. If you love the way the Bible describes the love of two people who want to share their lives together, you should have no problem making a legal, permanent, exclusive commitment." The bargain. In ancient times, there was the bride price. A prospective husband came to the father of a woman and offered him a certain sum, depending on factors such as the woman's beauty and the size of her inheritance. We see that old practice and say, "Oh, how awful that people did that." Today, however, we have moved beyond that. And because we are more democratic, men and women do it now to one another. We look at men and women sizing each other up and say, "She's in the market," and "He got a bad deal there," and "How did she ever fall for that sales pitch?" These offhand comments are telling. We tend to size up potential partners as to their assets and deficits. And in the end, we feel that we want to marry this person because he or she brings a lot to the table for us. It is almost impossible not to think in terms of how much I am putting into the marriage and how much my spouse is putting in. And if we are getting out of the relationship as much, or a bit more, we secretly hope, than we put in, then we are happy. But as time goes on, we come to see our spouse's flaws, and if those flaws persist, and we find that we are now not getting out of the marriage as much as we had hoped for when we made our initial investment, then we begin to do what anyone in a business does. If revenues are down, cut expenditures. And so if my wife is not being the wife she ought to be, I simply will not put in the effort to be the husband I used to be. It seems perfectly fair. She's not doing this like she used to. So why then should I do that? If I'm not going to get the same value, I don't need to put as much into this. You tell yourself at some semi-conscious level that this behavior is only fair and equitable, but it's really a form of revenge. This is how you justify your withdrawal in your mind, but of course your spouse doesn't see it quite that way. If my wife sees me being emotionally more remote, not being as active in serving her needs or the needs of the family, she will feel warranted to dial back her own involvement and commitment to me. The less you feel love, and the less you act loving, the less you feel loving. And so you both spiral down and down. Think for a moment how different a parent's relationship is with a child. If you have a child, you will find that the biblical pattern of love is forced on you. Your new child is the neediest human being you have ever met. She needs your care every second of the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You make enormous sacrifices in your life, and yet the child, for a very long time, gives you nothing in return. And, while later the child can give you love and respect, never does she give you anything like what you have given her. Often older children go through long stretches during which they rebel and fall apart and need enormous investment from you, and again give you nothing in return. But at every turn, whether or not they are giving to you, you give to them. After 18 years of this, even if your child is an unattractive person to everyone else, you can't help but love her dearly. Why? Because you've been forced to operate on the biblical pattern. You have had to do the actions of love regardless of your feelings, and therefore now you have deep feelings of love for your child, however lovable she is or not. It is not surprising, then, that after children leave home, many marriages fall apart. Why? Because while the parents treated their relationship with their children as a covenant relationship, performing the actions of love until their feelings strengthened, they treated their marriages as a consumer relationship and withdrew their actions of love when they weren't having the feelings. As a result, after 2 decades, their marriages were empty while their love for their children remained strong. He stayed. Many people hear this and say, "I'm sorry, I can't give love if I don't feel it. I can't fake it. That's too mechanical for me." I can understand that reaction. But Paul doesn't simply call us to a naked action. He also commands us to think as we act. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. This means we must say to ourselves something like this. Well, when Jesus looked down from the cross, he didn't think, "I am giving myself to you because you are so attractive to me." No. He was in agony, and he looked down at us. Denying him, abandoning him, and betraying him. And in the greatest act of love in history, he stayed. He said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they are doing." He loved us not because we were lovely to him, but to make us lovely. That is why I'm going to love my spouse. Speak to your heart like that, and then fulfill the promises you made on your wedding day. Chapter 4. The Mission of Marriage. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 through 27. We have spent time discussing what marriage is, but now let's ask, what is it for? What is the purpose of marriage? The Bible's answer to this question starts with the principle that marriage is a friendship. Loneliness in Paradise. In Genesis chapters 1 and 2, as God was creating the world, he looked at what he had done and repeatedly said that it was good. This assessment is given 7 times in the first chapter alone, emphasizing in the strongest possible manner how great and glorious the created material world is. It is striking, then, that after God created the first man, he said, "It is not good that the man should be alone." Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. It is striking not just by contrast with all we have read so far, but it raises a question. How could Adam be in a not good condition when he was in a perfect world and had, evidently, a perfect relationship with God? The answer may lie in the statement of God in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. "Let us make man in our own image, Readers instantly ask the question, who is us? Who is God talking to? One answer is that God is talking to the angels around him, but there is no indication anywhere in the Bible that the angels participated with God in the creation of human beings. Christian theologians over the centuries have seen here an allusion to a truth only revealed after the coming of Jesus into the world, namely, that God is triune, that the one God has existed from all eternity as three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit, who know and love one another. And therefore, among other things, being created in God's image means that we were designed for relationships. So, here is Adam, created by God and put into the Garden of Paradise, and yet his aloneness is not good. The Genesis narrative is implying that our intense relational capacity, created and given to us by God, was not fulfilled completely by our vertical relationship with him. God designed us to need horizontal relationships with other human beings. That is why even in paradise, loneliness was a terrible thing. We should therefore not be surprised to find that all the money, comforts, and pleasures in the world, our efforts to recreate a paradise for ourselves, are unable to fulfill us like love can. This is confirmation of our intuition that family and relationships are a greater blessing and provide greater satisfaction than anything money can buy. In response to being alone, God created what the text calls an ezer, a word that means a helper, companion, a friend. When the man sees the woman, he responds in poetry. At last, he says, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Some have proposed that he is saying, meeting you fills a void in me. And so we see that in the beginning, God gave the man a companion to be his spouse. The female speaker in Song of Solomon echoes Adam when she says, this is my lover, this is my friend. See chapter 5, verse 16. The character of friendship. What is friendship? The Bible, and particularly the book of Proverbs, spends much time describing and defining it. One of the prime qualities of a friend is constancy. Friends love at all times, and especially during adversity. See Proverbs chapter 17, verse 17. The counterfeit is a fair-weather friend who comes over when you are successful but goes away if prosperity, status, or influence wanes. See Proverbs chapter 14, verse 20, and chapter 19, verses 4, 6, and 7. True friends stick closer than a brother. See Proverbs chapter 18, verse 24. They are always there for you. Another of the essential characteristics of friendship is transparency and candor. Real friends encourage and affectionately affirm one another. See Proverbs chapter 27, verse 9, and 1 Samuel chapter 23, verses 16 through 18. Yet real friends also offer bracing critiques. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. See Proverbs chapter 27, verses 5 and 6. Like a surgeon, friends cut you in order to heal you. Friends become wiser together through a healthy clash of viewpoints. As iron sharpens iron, so friend sharpens friend. Proverbs chapter 27, verse 17. There are two features of real friendship, constancy and transparency. Real friends always let you in, and they never let you down. A writer once described a relationship that united these two things. She spoke of the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words, but pouring them all right out, just as they are, chaff and grain together, certain that a faithful hand will take and sift them, keep what is worth keeping, and then, with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away. However, there is a third quality to friendship, and it is not as easy to put into a single word. The right word literally is sympathy, sympathos, common passion. This means that friendships are discovered more than they are created at will. They arise between people who discover that they have common interests in and longings for the same things. Ralph Waldo Emerson and C.S. Lewis each wrote well-known essays about how a common vision can unite people of very different temperaments. Lewis insisted that the essence of friendship is the exclamation, "You two?" While erotic love can be depicted as two people looking at one another, friendship can be depicted as two people standing side by side, looking at the same object, and being stirred and entranced by it together. Lewis speaks of a secret thread that runs through the movies, books, art, music, pastimes, ideas, and scenery that most deeply move us. When we meet another person who shares this thread with us, there is the potential for a real friendship, if nurtured with transparency and constancy. The paradox is that friendship cannot be merely about itself. It must be about something else, something that both friends are committed to and passionate about besides one another. C.S. Lewis writes, "Friendship arises when two or more discover that they have in common some insight or interest. As Emerson said, 'Do you love me?' means, 'Do you see the same truth?' Or at least, 'Do you care about the same truth?' The man who agrees with us that some question, little regarded by others, is of great importance, can be our friend. And that is why those pathetic people who simply want friends can never make any. The very condition of having friends is that we should want something else besides friends. Where the truthful answer to the question, 'Do you see the same truth?' would be, 'I don't care about the truth. I only want you to be my friend,' no friendship can arise. Friendship must be about something, even if it were only an enthusiasm for dominoes or white mice. Those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers." Christian friendship. When we come to the New Testament, there is a new layer added to our understanding of friendship. Friendship is only possible where there is a common vision and passion. Think of what that means for all Christians. For believers in Christ, despite enormous differences in class, temperament, culture, race, sensibility, and personal history, there is an underlying commonality that is more powerful than them all. This is not so much a thread as an indestructible steel cable. Christians have all experienced the grace of God and the gospel of Jesus. We have all had our identity changed at the root. So now God's calling and love are more foundational to who we are than any other thing. And we also long for the same future, journey to the same horizon, what the Bible calls the new creation. Paul speaks of the good work God is doing in believers that will be complete at the end of time. See Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. We will become our true selves, the persons we were created to be, freed from all flaws, imperfections, and weaknesses. He speaks of the glory that will be revealed in us, the liberation from our bondage to decay, the glorious freedom of the children of God. See Romans chapter 8, verses 18 and 20. We hope and wait eagerly for this final and full redemption. See Romans chapter 8, verse 23. What does this mean? It means that any two Christians, with nothing else but a common faith in Christ, can have a robust friendship, helping each other on their journey toward the new creation, as well as doing ministry together in the world. How can they do that? They do it through spiritual transparency. Christian friends are not only to honestly confess their own sins to each other, see James chapter 5, verse 16, but they are to lovingly point out their friend's sins if he or she is blind to them, see Romans chapter 15, verse 14. You should give your Christian friends hunting licenses to confront you if you are failing to live in line with your commitments, see Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. Christian friends are to stir one another up, even provoking one another to get them off dead center, see Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. This isn't to happen infrequently, but should happen at a very concrete level every day. See Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13. Christian friends admit wrongs, offer or ask forgiveness. See Ephesians chapter 4, verse 32. And take steps to reconcile when one disappoints another. See Matthew chapter 5, verse 23, and chapter 18, verse 15. The other way is spiritual constancy. Christian friends bear each other's burdens. See Galatians chapter 6, verse 2. They should be there for each other through thick and thin. See 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 11, 14, and 15. Sharing their goods and their lives with each other if there is need. See Hebrews chapter 13, verse 16, Philippians chapter 4, verse 14, and 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 13. Friends must encourage each other through honor and affirmation. See Romans chapter 12, verses 3 through 6 and 10, and Proverbs chapter 27, verse 2. They are to identify and call out one another's gifts, strengths, and abilities. They are to build up each other's faith through study and common worship. See Colossians chapter 3, verse 16, and Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19. The picture that the Bible draws of spiritual friendship is remarkable. Christian friendship is not simply about going to concerts together or enjoying the same sporting event. It is the deep oneness that develops as two people journey together toward the same destination, helping one another through the dangers and challenges along the way. There have been numerous buddy movies made over the years, of all types and all levels of artistic merit, from the leather stocking tales of James Fenimore Cooper to the 1960s film The Dirty Dozen to the classic The Lord of the Rings. In each story, a disparate group of people are brought together. They may come from different races and classes and may hate one another, but because some common goal and mission is thrust on them, they become a team, a unit. They rescue each other, push, provoke, and exhort each other, and win through because their common mission turns them into friends, and their differences become their strengths. How does this supernatural friendship that can exist between any two Christians relate to the natural human friendship described by Emerson and Lewis, which is based on the common thread of similar loves and passions? The answer is that they can overlap or coincide. A Christian can become great friends with a non-Christian who, for example, shares her enthusiasm for an author. They read the author's books and meet to talk enthusiastically and joyfully about what they loved in the books. If the two friends are also, say, young mothers, then they have another basis for friendship, and the friendship can become warm and close despite a lack of common Christian faith. As we have shown, two Christians can have the spiritual friendship described in the one anothering directives of the New Testament, even if temperamentally and in every other way the two are extremely different and, humanly speaking, incompatible. Perhaps the richest and best relationships, however, are those that combine both the natural and the supernatural elements. Marriage, of course, can add the power of romantic love to the natural and supernatural bonds of friendship, and this is what can make marriage the richest of all human relationships. Friendship is a deep oneness that develops as two people, speaking the truth in love to each other, journey together to the same horizon. Spiritual friendship is the greatest journey of all, because the horizon is so high and far, yet sure. It is nothing less than the day of Jesus Christ, and what we will be like when we finally see him face to face. The Apostle John writes, "Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. All who have this hope in him purify themselves, just as he is pure." 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. Your spouse as your best friend. When God brought the first man, his spouse, He brought him not just a lover, but the friend his heart had been seeking. Proverbs chapter 2, verse 17 speaks of one's spouse as your all-up, a unique word that the lexicons define as your special confidant or best friend. In an age where women were often seen as the husband's property, and marriages were mainly business deals and transactions seeking to increase the family's social status and security, it was startling for the Bible to describe a spouse in this way. But in today's society, with its emphasis on romance and sex, it is just as radical to insist that your spouse should be your best friend, though for a different reason. In tribal societies, romance doesn't matter as much as social status. And in individualistic Western societies, romance and great sex matter far more than anything else. The Bible, however, without ignoring responsibility to the community or the importance of romance, puts great emphasis on marriage as companionship. We see it in our text, Ephesians chapter 5. Here, Paul is speaking to people from pagan backgrounds and to their view that marriage is mainly a social transaction. In that time, you had to marry as well as you could for the sake of your family's social status. Your wife's job was to link your family to another good family and then bear children. That was what marriage was supposed to accomplish. Paul, however, gives his readers a vision for marriage that must have completely astonished them. The primary goal of Christian marriage is not social status and stability, as it was in ancient cultures, nor is it primarily romantic and emotional happiness, as it is in our culture today. Paul points husbands to Jesus' sacrificial love toward us, his bride. But Paul does not stop there. He goes on to speak of the goal of that sacrificial love for his bride. It is to sanctify her, verse 26, to present her to himself in radiant beauty and splendor, verse 27a, to bring her to be perfectly holy and blameless, verse 27c. He wants the new creation for us. He wants to remove all spiritual stains, flaws, sins, and blemishes to make us holy, glorious, and blameless. In another place, Paul tells all the Christians in Philippi that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion in the day of Christ Jesus, chapter 1, verse 6. This speaks of a process begun the day we believed in Jesus that has traditionally been named sanctification. Paul is saying we should not think that process will be complete before the end of time. We should never think we can achieve perfection here and now. But he also warns us against losing hope. He will bring the work to completion. Slowly but surely, by the power of the Spirit, we will put on our new self, created to be like God. See Ephesians chapter 4, verse 24. During this life, as we trust in God and come to know Him, we are being transformed into Christ's likeness from one degree of splendor to the next. See 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18. Even, or especially, the sufferings we experience can make us wiser, deeper, stronger, better. Therefore we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Therefore, we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16, 17, and 18. How can Paul say to all Christians that the work of new creation that was begun in us will be brought to completion? Because Jesus is present with us, overseeing the work. He is the ultimate friend who sticks closer than a brother. He will never let us down. He is committed to making us into the glorious, unique person that we can be in Him. In John chapter 15, verses 9 through 15, this is accomplished because He is our divine friend. But in Ephesians chapter 5, he accomplishes this because he is our divine husband. In his redemptive work, Jesus is both friend and lover. And this is to be the model for spouses in marriage. Husband and wife are to be both lovers and friends to one another, as Jesus is to us. Jesus has a vision of our future glory. See Colossians chapter 1, verse 27, and 1 John chapter 3, verse 2. And everything he does in our lives moves us toward that goal. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 28 directly links the purpose of every marriage to the purpose of the ultimate marriage. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives. And how could it be otherwise? If any two unrelated Christians are to provoke each other toward love and goodness, see Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24, are to affirm each other's gifts and hold each other accountable to grow out of their sins, see Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13, how much more should a husband and wife do that? This principle, that your spouse should be capable of becoming your best friend, is a game changer when you address the question of compatibility in a prospective spouse. If you think of marriage largely in terms of erotic love, then compatibility means sexual chemistry and appeal. If you think of marriage largely as a way to move into the kind of social status in life you desire, then compatibility means being part of the desired social class, and perhaps common tastes and aspirations for lifestyle. The problem with these factors is that they are not durable. Physical attractiveness will wane, no matter how hard you work to delay its departure. And socioeconomic status, unfortunately, can change almost overnight. When people think they have found compatibility based on these things, they often make the painful discovery that they have built their relationship on unstable ground. A woman lets herself go, or a man loses his job, and the compatibility foundation falls apart. But worst of all, sexual attraction and social class relatability do not give you any common vision. What is your marriage for? Where are you going? If you have mainly mutual, material, and financial goals, that will serve to bring unity for a while. But such goals do not create deep oneness, for eventually you reach them, or you don't. And then what? If you marry mainly a sexual partner or mainly a financial partner, you are going nowhere together, really. And those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. The Great Horizon. What then is marriage for? It is for helping each other to become our future glory selves, the new creation that God will eventually make us. The common horizon husband and wife look toward is the throne, and the holy, spotless, and blameless nature we will have. I can think of no more powerful common horizon than that. And that is why putting a Christian friendship at the heart of a marriage relationship can lift it to a level that no other vision for marriage approaches. Have you ever traveled to a mountainous part of the world when it was cloudy and rainy? You look out your windows and you can see almost nothing but the ground. Then the rain stops, and the clouds part, and you catch your breath because there, towering right over you, is this magnificent peak. But a couple of hours later, the clouds roll in and it has vanished, and you don't see it again for a good while. That is what it is like to get to know a Christian. You have an old self and a new self. See Ephesians chapter 4, verse 24. The old self is crippled with anxieties, the need to prove yourself, bad habits you can't break, and many besetting sins and entrenched character flaws. The new self is still you, but you liberated from all your sins and flaws. This new self is always a work in progress, and sometimes the clouds of the old self make it almost completely invisible. But sometimes, the clouds really part, and you see the wisdom, courage, and love of which you are capable. It is a glimpse of where you are going. Within this Christian vision for marriage, here's what it means to fall in love. It is to look at another person and get a glimpse of the person God is creating, and to say, I see who God is making you, and it excites me. I want to be part of that. I want to partner with you and God in the journey you are taking to his throne. And when we get there, I will look at your magnificence and say, I always knew you could be like this. I got glimpses of it on earth, but now look at you. Each spouse should see the great thing that Jesus is doing in the life of their mate through the Word, the Gospel. Each spouse, then, should give him or herself to be a vehicle for that work and envision the day that you will stand together before God, seeing each other presented in spotless beauty and glory. My wife, Kathy, often says that most people, when they are looking for a spouse, are looking for a finished statue, when they should be looking for a wonderful block of marble. Not so you can create the kind of person you want, but rather because you see what kind of person Jesus is making. When Michelangelo was asked how he carved his magnificent David, his reply is reputed to have been, I looked inside the marble and just took away the bits that weren't David. When looking for a marriage partner, each must be able to look inside the other and see what God is doing and be excited about being part of the process of liberating the emerging new you. C.S. Lewis writes, If we let him, he will make the feeblest and filthiest of us into a god or goddess, a dazzling, radiant, immortal creature pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love that we cannot now imagine, a bright, stainless mirror which reflects back to God perfectly, though, of course, on a smaller scale, his own boundless power and delight and goodness. The process will be long and in parts very painful, but that is what we are in for, nothing less. This is by no means a naive, romanticized approach. Rather, it is brutally realistic. In this view of marriage, each person says to the other, I see all your flaws, imperfections, weaknesses, dependencies, but underneath them all, I see growing the person God wants you to be. This is radically different from the search for compatibility. As we have seen, researchers have discovered that this term means we are looking for a partner who accepts us just as we are. This is the very opposite of that. The search for an ideal mate is a hopeless quest. This is also a radically different approach from the cynical or cold method of finding a spouse who can just deliver social status, financial security, or great sex. If you don't see your mate's deep flaws and weaknesses and dependencies, you're not even in the game. But if you don't get excited about the person your spouse has already grown into and will become, you aren't tapping into the power of marriage as spiritual friendship. The goal is to see something absolutely ravishing that God is making of the beloved. You see even now flashes of glory. You want to help your spouse become the person God wants him or her to be. When two Christians who fully understand this stand before the minister, all decked out in their wedding finery, they realize they're not just playing dress-up. What they're saying is that someday they are going to be standing not before the minister but before the Lord, and they will turn to each other without spot and blemish. And they hope to hear God say, Well done, good and faithful servants. Over the years you have lifted one another up to me. You sacrificed for one another. You held one another up with prayer and with thanksgiving. You confronted each other. You rebuked each other. You hugged, and you loved each other, and continually pushed each other toward me. And now look at you. You're radiant. Romance, sex, laughter, and plain fun are the byproducts of this process of sanctification, refinement, glorification. Those things are important, but they can't keep the marriage going through years and years of ordinary life. What keeps the marriage going is your commitment to your spouse's holiness. You're committed to his or her beauty. You're committed to his greatness and perfection. You're committed to her honesty and passion for the things of God. That's your job as a spouse. Any lesser goal than that, any smaller purpose, and you're just playing at being married. Now we can see how marriage as friendship agrees so well with love as commitment. On the cross, Jesus did not look down on us with a heart full of admiration and affection. He felt no chemistry. But he gave himself. He put our needs ahead of his own. He sacrificed for us. But the Bible tells spouses not only to imitate the quality and manner of Christ's love, but also the goal of it. Jesus died not because we were lovely, but to make us lovely. He died, Paul says, to make us holy. Paradoxically, this means Paul is urging spouses to help their mates love Jesus more than them. It's a paradox, but not a contradiction. The simple fact is that only if I love Jesus more than my wife will I be able to serve her needs ahead of my own. Only if my emotional tank is filled with love from God will I be able to be patient, faithful, tender, and open with my wife when things are not going well in life or in the relationship. And the more joy I get from my relationship with Christ, the more I can share that joy with my wife and family. A message for our culture. Paul's teaching about marriage was certainly radical for ancient traditional cultures, but it may be just as radical a message for today's society. It often happens that you have a good friend of the opposite sex with whom you share common commitments. You trust this person's wisdom, and you find you can open up and share many intimate things without fear. He or she understands you well and listens to you and gives you great advice, but the person doesn't attract you romantically. Maybe he or she doesn't have the body type that you find appealing. You find no sexual chemistry at all. Then, imagine that you meet someone else to whom you feel very attracted. This person has the physical and social attributes you have been looking for and is interested in you too. So you start seeing each other and have a lot of fun together, and things are moving along into more and more romantic intimacy. But if you are honest with yourself, this person you say you are falling in love with does not make nearly as good a friend as the one you already have, nor is that likely to change. You are in trouble. Your spouse has got to be your best friend, or be on the way to becoming your best friend, or you won't have a strong, rich marriage that endures, and that makes you both vastly better persons for having been in it. I'm not saying that you should marry someone when you feel no attraction. The Bible does indicate that your spouse must be more than your dearest friend, but not less. Most of us know that there is some truth in the stereotype that men overvalue beauty in a prospective spouse, and that women overvalue wealth in a potential mate. But if you marry someone more for these things than for friendship, you not only are setting yourself up for future failure, wealth may and sexual appeal will decrease, but you are also setting yourself up for loneliness. For what Adam in the garden needed was not just a sexual partner, but a companion, bone of his bones and flesh of his flesh. If singles accept this principle, it would drastically change the way people seek a marriage partner in our day. It is typical for a single person to walk into a room and see a number of people of the opposite sex and immediately begin to screen them, not for companionship, but for attractiveness. Let's say 3 out of 10 look appealing. The next step is to approach those 3 to see what rapport there might be. If one of them will agree to go out on a date, and you get romantically involved, perhaps you'll see if you can turn that person into a friend as well. The problem is, many of your best prospects for friendship were likely among those you ruled out because they were too tall or too short, too fat or too skinny. We think of a prospective spouse as primarily a lover or a provider. And if he or she can be a friend on top of that, well, isn't that nice? We should be going at it the other way around. Screen first for friendship. Look for someone who understands you better than you do yourself, who makes you a better person just by being around them, and then explore whether that friendship could become a romance and a marriage. So many people go about their dating starting from the wrong end, and they end up in marriages that aren't really about anything and aren't going anywhere. The priority of marriage. There is one very important implication of this principle of marriage as friendship. If you see your spouse as mainly a sexual partner or a financial partner, you will find that you will need pursuits outside of marriage to really engage your whole soul. In that case, children, parents, career, political or social activism, hobbies, or a network of close friends, one or more of those things will capture your imagination, provide joy and meaning, and absorb emotional energy more than your marriage. And that will be deadly. Your marriage will slowly die if your spouse senses that he or she is not the first priority in your life. But only if your spouse is not just your lover and financial partner, but your best friend, is it possible for your marriage to be your most important and fulfilling relationship. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul quotes Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, namely that when a man marries, he leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife. Western people are not shocked when they read this command, but they should be. Think of the historical and social context of that statement. Ancient cultures put enormous emphasis on the parent-child relationship. Pleasing your parents, being faithful to the wishes of your parents, was all important. In more traditional cultures, even today, parents and grandparents are given